Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Show topics and guests focus on raising public awareness about local and regional concerns. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. There are more than 300 miles of ocean along the central coast of California between Santa Cruz and Carpinteria. The ocean is of critical importance to the California Central Coast way of life. It serves our community in many different ways as a source of food, recreation, community, commerce, spiritual health, as well as regulating our climate and sustaining energy production. So how healthy are our oceans? Are our fisheries sustainable? How is climate change affecting our oceans? We'll be answering some of these questions and probably a lot more in today's show with my guests, Dr. Dean Wendt, Professor of Research at Cal Poly in Biological Sciences Department and Director for the Center of Coastal Marine Sciences and Executive Director of SLOSEA. Also with me today is Dr. Douglas McCauley, who is joining us by phone. Dr. McCauley is an assistant professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Marine Biology at UC Santa Barbara, and Dr. Crow White, assistant professor of marine science in biology department at California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo. And that one's always such a tough, long one. It's easier for me to say Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. But today's show is live, and you can be a part of our discussion by calling in with your questions and comments. To make sure your comments get on the air, please call in early. The number to call, 781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875. And professors, it's good to have all three of you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here. Good to be with you, Crow and Dean.
You as well, Doug.
Excellent. So, you know, if we get started, probably the best place for us to start is, how are we doing in terms of the overall health of our oceans? If you were going to give it a grade, what kind of a grade would you give it?
Okay. Well,
Crow's kind of
yeah.
I'm smirking because recently some scientists did try to give it a grade.
Yes. Yeah.
And the grade was a D plus.
Seriously?
Yes.
It's kind of like my report card. That's not good.
But there's good news too, and I think Doug could speak to that.
That's right. So I mean, I think it's a sort of a matter of putting things in perspective. I wouldn't at all disagree with what Crow just said and what some of our colleagues, our colleagues in marine science have said, which is that we're not doing well by the oceans, a sort of well-deserved D+, unfortunately. But the thing is, if you actually, as a way to try to sort out how bad are these impacts, a good way to sort that out is sort of line up how much influence and how much change we've engineered in the oceans versus the amount of impact we've had on land. And if you do that, actually, the story gets a lot brighter. So the impacts we've had on the oceans are just a fraction of what we've done to the land. And you can see that sort of over and over in different data sources, like extinction, 500 animal extinctions on land, only 15 in the oceans in the last 500 years. So a bit of good news, maybe.
That's pretty amazing. So if we're getting a D+, in the ocean, I'm assuming we're doing a lot worse in terms of a grade on land.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's probably the case. I mean, I guess we get an F- in a lot of ways on land, and it's just because we've used up a lot of resources, used a lot of space, changed animal communities in ways that, I mean, these are the systems we interact with day in and day out. So it sort of makes sense that that's where our strongest footprint ought to be. But I think the most important thing in drawing out these comparisons is just making sure that we don't do some of these same things in the oceans.
Yeah. Well, I was going to add to that by saying that, I mean, that what we need, what's essential in this is doing the appropriate research and monitoring so that you can understand the state of the oceans and then take actions that are based in your understanding of how the ocean works. And one of the major issues that we have is it's a very complex ecosystem. The ecosystems on land tend to be simpler in many ways than the ocean ecosystems, which are much more dynamic. And it's essential that we have scientists like Crow and Doug doing the work that they're doing so that we can break down and mechanistically understand the factors that are impacting the ocean and then take appropriate actions to mitigate those impacts.
When you talk about grades being assigned, you're giving those grades based on the kind of research that you're talking about, right?
That is a global grade too.
Sure.
California is doing quite well. We've gone through our crash. We've gone through the hard times with the fisheries in California, and then because of some pretty extensive regulations, austerity measures, if you will, we have fisheries that are coming back and that are on the track to being more sustainable. So it's a higher grade if you look locally.
Yeah, and I would just say that California really is a world leader in many ways in the efforts that it's putting forth to manage its oceans sustainably.
Is that starting to show up a little bit? Because I think for years we were kind of touted as being over the top in terms of our attempts to conserve or protect, and that was just the left side of silliness, if you will, and ultra-conservative. And now what you're saying is those things have really demonstrated that they've had an impact already.
We are the global model of establishing a network of conservation areas along coasts. Other countries are looking at us as to how we did it, how we involved the public as stakeholder groups in the process, how we dealt with the confrontation, because there certainly was and still is confrontation, in order to establish parks in the sea and also maintain fisheries in between those parks.
What has had the biggest impact in California in improving our circumstances?
I think that it's the in the late 90s we shifted from a form of managing resources that sort of had the, this is a very general way to put it, but if you don't have information, you don't have data, you could still continue activity, whether that be fisheries or recreating or what have you. But the whole country shifted to, and California in particular, shifted to a regulatory environment where we demanded that in order to continue an activity, you actually needed information. And what that did was that approach necessarily shut down or greatly curtailed a lot of the activity. And over the last decade and a half, we've been collecting more data and more information. And as we're learning more, I mean, that gave the resource a rest, essentially. But then as we're learning more, we're able to do more thoughtful management that is sustainable.
Was the demand for information saying that without being able to demonstrate that this wouldn't have a negative impact, you cannot move forward?
Correct.
Okay.
Right. And so that frame shift really alters the activity level.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
And so another thing in the mix too, just things that California seems to be doing right, and just as Chris said, is sort of leading the world almost in marine policy, is what we've done in the past few decades for marine protected areas, that we have various different kinds of parks in the oceans. And I mean, I think everyone kind of gets the sense that parks are really good for wildlife. If you want to see deer, you go to Yosemite, right? So if you mm-hmm. want to see big fish, you go to some of these parks in the oceans. And we've really, and I'd say Crow said it well, you know, had a lot of strong dialogue and a lot of constructive dialogue about where to put these, how to make them so that they benefit biodiversity and don't impair livelihoods, fishing livelihoods that are so important to the economy of our state. And so the result of all this is this network of marine protected areas that is really first rate globally and has, I think, done quite a lot for marine biodiversity along the Central Coast and California in general, and is certainly something for us all to be very proud of.
For those of us that don't understand what the marine parks are, can you give a bigger picture of what that would look like for someone?
Sure. Mm-hmm. They're generally called marine protected areas, mm-hmm. and they are actual spatial areas. You know, they have coordinates that say where they are and outline their corners. And within them are rules on what you can and cannot do. The most strict ones say that you cannot fish anything within them. You cannot mine anything within them. You can't dump anything within them. And then there are others that say you can only fish some species. Mm-hmm. Or there are others that say recreational fishermen may fish in there, but commercial fishermen cannot. Sometimes they have seasonal regulations. And then some of them have no fishing rules, but then they allow other activities.
And how are they selected?
Oh, that was a major process. And that involved a wide array of people from the Department of Fish and Game at the time, or Fish and Wildlife. So that's the authority, the government authority over the marine protected areas in California. It involved a science advisory team. So a group of scientists that were assembled that had information about the way marine protected areas work, a series of guidelines about how far apart they should be and what size is best depending on the species you want to protect. And then there was a stakeholder group that consisted of different elements in the community. It would, you know, universities, nonprofits, fishing organizations, anybody who has a stake in the establishment of this network of marine protected areas. And then that group developed proposals that were evaluated for their efficacy against scientific guidelines. And then that they came up with preferred scenarios, trading off a series of factors that were metrics for how they were performing. And then that information was all moved to what's a Blue Ribbon Task Force, which was an appointed policy group that then made a decision about this was the preferred alternative. That then went to the Fish and Game Commission, who enacted it. Mm-hmm. And established the reserves. And so the Central Coast of California, from Point Conception in Santa Barbara County up through southern Santa Cruz County, was the first region to go through this in 2007. And we established somewhere around 30 marine protected areas along the coast that are protecting about 18% of the coastline.
And the research is being done consistently to see what the impact is.
Exactly. Yeah. And
there is some research being done.
Okay.
But one of the things that I think every scientist and even every manager will say is, and every fisherman too, is not enough.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have enough information, but there are some, and Cal Poly is deeply involved in monitoring that's been happening since the inception of the reserves and the marine protected areas in
and
this area.
UCSB too?
Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think the beginning of the process. I'm a bit a younger blood in marine science, but quite a few of the...
Did he just call me old?
Here.
No, I think you're the young blood he was referring to.
A respected elder whom I should be listening to very carefully here.
Something to point out, when Dean said the marine protected areas, that the alternative designs were evaluated in relation to metrics, I think it's important to point out that those metrics were both biological and economic. Mm-hmm. So it was trying to be a fair evaluation of essentially how much fish biomass and diversity would be protected from these, but then also how much fish biomass could be caught in the remaining areas, how much economic value would be procured throughout the remaining areas given a marine protected area design. And so it was looking at things that were of interest to different parties, and different, some stakeholder groups were all about one and some were all about the other and some were interested in both. And it was that discussion among all the different groups that eventually led to the one design that was chosen for our Central Coast.
And this was enacted in 2007.
Yes.
When was it started? How long did it take all of those different parties to come together?
It's the Marine Life Protection Act and the Marine Life Management Act in the late 90s that stated that this process needed to be done.
I'm amazed it went that quickly.
And, well, it had a lot of failed. It had three failed starts.
Oh, it did.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it takes a while to learn how to implement something
sure.
so complex and controversial.
Yeah.
And so, right, it did happen relatively quickly, like a decade.
Considering, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. What was the biggest – go ahead, Doug.
I was just going to introduce the sense that, you know, a lot of us are really interested in the benefits of marine protected areas, and there are many. You know, and I think there is a lot of sentiment, though, amongst scientists and amongst fishermen and other users of the ocean that this is just one tool, though, in our toolkit. I mean, if you sort of put things in perspective globally – we've put into protected areas only 3% of the ocean, and that's a pretty ambitious number. In fact, you know, if you actually talked, as Crow was saying, there's sort of different tiers of management. If you go to very strict tiers, then it could be closer to 1%. So, you know, it's a really important way for us to think about keeping this resource that's so important to fishermen, so important to users of the ocean, healthy. But there's a whole lot of ocean in between these marine protected areas that it never will be in a marine park, never will be in a marine protected area. And so there's a lot of thought and there's a lot of discussion in science about what do we do about issues in the oceans in this vast matrix around these marine protected areas.
Right. Are there other countries that have enacted this kind of an approach?
There's quite a few that are also doing. I mean, so New Zealand is often talked of as being progressive at the same level as California is. Australia also. It's countries often that have a large stake in the oceans. You know, Australia in the Great Barrier Reef, right? The income that's coming into some of those states along that coastline near the Great Barrier Reef, it basically fuels entire cities, right? The income from people coming in to see the biodiversity, the fish and the corals and these reefs. So they get it. They need to leave that there and keep it healthy for, you know, not decades but centuries. So usually when you see, you know, progressive action like these marine protected areas, it's an area where they have no choice but to keep these marine resources healthy.
Was there a lot of resistance from fishermen in this project?
Sure. Oh yeah, there was.
And today they're cooperative with this? I mean, is it something that there's a collaboration?
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that I've had some experience working in the fishing communities here in Morro Bay and Port San Luis and getting fishermen engaged in scientific research to inform management. And one of the projects that we developed at Cal Poly with colleagues up in the Monterey area at Moss Landing Marine Labs was engaging the primary fishing interest that was impacted by the marine protected areas in the research required to understand the effect of the marine protected areas on that resource. And so we've been working since 2007, going out every year with the fishing community in implementing a very rigorous science-based protocol that was developed with fisheries regulators at NOAA and Fish and Wildlife to collect the information we need to know in order to manage those areas and understand what the impact is. And so I can tell you that the resistance, I was on the science advisory team for the Central Coast. There was huge resistance and animosity from the fishing communities about this, understandably.
Sure.
And I have seen that as the system has gone into an equilibrium of sorts. You know, people get used to the new state and they figure out how to make it work. That we've done some of that. And they're also engaged in collecting the data that is used for understanding the area. So that process, I think, has also built some buy-in and involvement in the network of marine protected areas. And I'm not here speaking for the fisherman's perspective on this because I couldn't do that.
Of course.
But we are collaborating, and I think they see the fishing communities want data because they believe that the ocean is doing okay, and they know that data is their ticket to access, sustainable access.
Okay. You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 89.5 Santa Barbara, and available all around the world at kcbx.org. You're listening right now to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker, and my guests today are Dr. Dean Nguyen, Professor and Dean of Research at Cal Poly, the Biological Sciences Department, and the Director of the Center for Coastal Marine Sciences and the Executive Director of SLOSEA.
Man's got a lot of titles.
And they're tongue twisters. Thank you very much.
You know your credibility is inversely proportional to the number of titles you have.
But it all sounds so good. Dr. Douglas McCauley is joining us by telephone today. Dr. McCauley is an assistant professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Marine Biology at UC Santa Barbara. And Dr. Crow White, assistant professor of marine science in the biology department for Cal Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo. And we're talking about the critical need for understanding ocean health and managing its resources. Certainly welcome your phones calls for questions or comments about today's topic. You can reach us at 781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875. And Crow.
Well, we've talked a lot about fisheries, and I would like to progress to us talking about looking forward in the sense that we are entering an era where fishermen are no longer the only, maybe not even the biggest player out in our coastal oceans. We've got people requesting permits for aquaculture farms. We've got industry requesting permits for offshore wind and wave energy farms. And we're entering an era where the coastal oceans could ramp up in their crowdedness.
We'll talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think one of the reasons I'm bringing this up is because some of the work by Doug has shown that we are basically following with a lag what we've done on land. And so, Doug, maybe you could give a little intro on where we are on that.
Sure, Crow. Yeah, so what we did was we sort of had a look at this case or the situation that Crow was just describing, which was, are we kind of in this transitional period where we're moving from fishing to new change, new use of the oceans? And so we looked at a bunch of different data sources, both about how the oceans are changing and how we're changing our use of the oceans. And as Chris suggested, it seems in all of this data we reviewed that we are indeed at the threshold of change. What seems to be happening is we're moving from a period where the main concern, the main discussions, and the main impacts we've had on biodiversity in the oceans has been direct impacts by fishing, by all the kinds of different fishing-related activities, trawling and that sort of thing, us chasing down seafood in the ocean. Now it seems that we're switching to a period where we actually use ocean space, where we use habitat or changing habitats, and just as you said, Kira, that change happened on land. It happened about the same time of the Industrial Revolution. We used to just hunt things directly, whether they were passenger pigeons or buffalo. We were after them for meat, for pelts, you know, for them as products. And then we needed their space. We needed the resources that they that these wildlife on land were after. And when this switch occurred, again during the 1700s or 1800s, when we switched to really degrading terrestrial habitats, habitats on land, we saw a major spike in extinction. So if we're looking at this kind of switch where we're moving towards using more ocean space in different ways through energy and mining and farming, aquaculture, then we have to be really careful about how we engage these new kinds of marine industries so that we don't end up sort of remaking the past in the oceans, remaking these kinds of extinctions and rapid and unwanted change in the sea. So, yeah, I think a lot of us are looking hard at this new, you know, some people call it an industrial revolution in the oceans. Some people call it a, you know, sort of more friendly a version of that is a blue economy, a burgeoning blue economy. But a lot of scientists are looking carefully at what can we do to engage this development to make it happen constructively and actively and healthily, but not with negative consequences on the ocean.
Have we learned enough from what we've done on land to have the protections built in as we move into the oceans to be able to not reproduce the same thing?
And the biggest lesson we've learned is that if we're not proactive, then we will end up with way more industrialized and developed spaces and way less protected space.
And so is the industrialization already happening?
I would say so. You know, so we actually looked at a handful, but in the very, very earliest stages, we looked at a handful of industry indicators, for example, right? So how many marine offshore wind turbines are there in the world? And in the past decade, it's gone from almost none to thousands out there. Seabed mining. Now, this isn't so much an issue for us here at all in coastal California, but, you know, as being connected to the Pacific Ocean, it's a major issue for our larger neighbor, the Pacific Ocean. We've staked out over 1 million square kilometers of seabed that we intend to mine. So, you know, and that's all happened in the past few decades. But mm-hmm. We're really at the beginning of this. You know, we've staked out these areas that we want to develop, we want to mine. We haven't, in some cases, started to do it yet. So just, you know, as Chris said, this is the time to be proactive because it hasn't begun with a whole lot of momentum. We see the first indications of this starting.
So what's built into that so that the approach resembles the one that has shown to be effective, which is to have research and data along the way where you're mining that data and then you're following, I'm assuming, what the data is showing so that you're following it into something positive and staying away from something negative.
Mm-hmm.
What's built in right now, or is it?
Well, we're on the precipice of trying to make this happen, and not just the four of us talking here, but mm-hmm. Society and government is working. I mean, essentially, we want good information that is describing the oceans and good information that can describe the predicted impacts of various activities on the oceans. And that's the first phase of this or component
right.
to this. And then the second component is taking that information into account, really thinking about it carefully and the interaction. And the term that scientists often use for that is ecosystem-based management.
Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to take into account not only how different species interact with each other, and if you harvest one but not another one, how might that kind of shift
right.
the underwater world, but also how different ocean use activities are interacting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Can they be complementary? Then that's great. Then they could happen in the same location. On the other hand, do they conflict with each other? Well, then that's a problem that we need to think carefully about. Well, okay, well, which one is going to go where? How big is each one going to be? So that we can come up with an overall plan of growth of our ocean use that meets our overall societal interest of what we want the oceans to look like. And it's not just biodiversity conservation. It's also protecting our cultural heritage, like fisheries. Like,
right.
you know, we don't want fisheries to get squeezed out
right.
by these other industries that are extremely lucrative, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we want to maintain a balance that reflects society's interests. And that's
right.
all ecosystem-based management.
We're going to go to a call here. Allie, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi. You had a question or comment?
Yes, I did. I was wondering if you all believe that farmed fishing is a sustainable option for helping increase the health of our oceans, and how does this compare to other sustainable fishing practices?
So aquaculture or farmed fishing, without a doubt, is a part of our future. And the key thing is that it's done in a careful way. If you think on land, with all the people here, we can no longer survive on bushmeat alone. We have to cultivate crops in order to feed ourselves. Well, in the oceans, we are likely going to face a similar situation where we need to farm some fish in order to produce all the protein. The rub is that if we get too industrial, if we pack it in too tightly, the fish and the fish farms, then things could really blow up in our face. And so this is where careful management, this is where some precautionary regulatory measures come into place in order to ensure that the aquaculture farms are not too dense, that they don't use, say, antibiotics so intensively that it has evolutionary changes on those fish and the wild fish that are nearby, and that it isn't just so big in its coverage that it's displacing areas where people can go and fish on their own or where other fish might like to swim on their own.
And, you know, we've been talking a lot about the differences between practices on land and activities on mm-hmm. land and contrasting that with the ocean. And I mentioned earlier in the program that how complex marine ecosystems are. And a lot of times our most desired species from the ocean sit on the top of the food chain. And in contrast to, what we raise on land, which are often herbivores, right? They're eating grass directly.
Yes.
Oftentimes, we're interested in species that have feeding on animals that are feeding on animals that are feeding on plants
in the marine system.
Realm. And every time you go up another trophic level, as it's called, that takes a lot of energy. And so if you transition that into an aquaculture environment, you're actually to raise, a pound of that top predator, it takes a tremendous amount of energy. And so it's not ecologically efficient. And so it's something to keep in mind.
Yeah.
And another, important part about aquaculture is that, and Crow's right, if we're going to feed the masses, that, we're going to have to turn to some sorts of aquaculture to do it. But there's a trade-off, a cultural trade-off, and ecosystem-based management tries to think about all sorts of trade-offs. And one of them, it's not just ecological, but there are social trade-offs. And, fishing communities, there's a heritage there. And if we can magically make everything produced, in the ocean in an ecological way, and we can produce a lot of food, if that happens and it outcompetes our fishing industries, we have to take into account that we could lose that cultural value, that heritage value that's very important to these coastal communities.
Right.
And so this idea of ecosystem-based management really tries to take into account that bigger picture.
It's a real global picture.
Yeah, and make explicit mm-hmm. all of those trade-offs when you're making decisions about
right.
how you manage resources.
Right, right. Doug?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, asking this question, and I agree completely with Jean and Crow, but just getting this dialogue open on aquaculture is incredibly important because I think many people don't realize how rapidly it's growing. And the global figure, the case is a little bit different here in California, actually quite a lot different, but mm-hmm. the global figure is that in 20 years, two decades, that there's going to be more fish put on our plates from aquaculture than there is from wild-caught fisheries. So it's growing incredibly rapidly, particularly so in areas like Asia, but just trying to learn more about some of these issues like the Dean raised about increasing the efficiency of this are going to be so important because with so much momentum behind the growth of aquaculture, it's not a matter of saying yes or no. It's a matter of sort of getting into this process and thinking about how to do it more intelligently, there's absolutely going to be a need at the global level for this new food. You know, with the current projections of population growth and increasing interest in bringing more protein in our diets, and generally that's a good thing because protein is very closely associated with good human health, that we need more fish to feed those more mouths. And aquaculture is part of the solution, but there's dirty aquaculture and there's clean aquaculture. And we're getting more information on how to make the dirty aquaculture clean, and we need to get that to the places where it's growing so rapidly.
Okay, great. Allie, did that answer your question?
It did, absolutely. Thank you all so much.
All right.
Thanks, Allie.
Thanks for calling, Allie.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Don, you had a question.
Hello?
Don, are you there?
Oh, yeah.
Hi, did you have a comment or a question?
Well, I actually had a comment. I'm an environmentalist, and I'm also a sea rancher. My operation has a conservation ethic built into it, and I fish sustainably and in that frame of mind for years. And I've watched this management and been a victim, or well, as participant in the management scenario that's been being described here. And I wanted to suggest people consider that a lot of this is based on deceptive innovations that sound good and they sound complex. And we figure they're probably good. But I watched in practice how fishery management has utilized non-science in their draconian effects on fishing management to the effect of, similar to mowing your lawn with a backhoe. And they even have tried to avoid the statistical analysis that it would take to have a proper science behind a lot of their proposals and adopt the proposal anyway. This was actually such as their statistical analysis around Bayesian technique as opposed to frequentist technique. But this is probably way beyond the can of this conversation. But I just wanted to point out to people that if you factor in that all that's been said and done in fisheries in the last 30 years has a whole lot to do with the privatization scheme and scenario that has been irresponsible social, economically, and psychosocially with many groups. And you mentioned New Zealand earlier. Something to factor in here is the fact that 85% of all the fish quota owned by two corporations at this point, maybe even more by now. And if that's any kind of a direction to go, any country that's been utilized, it's happened similarly. And now that they're doing it in this country, I find it rather appalling in its effect on people, and it's legally and I'd say sociologically irresponsible. And I can go on, but I do have a bumper sticker that thanks the National Marine Fisheries Service for 30 years of destroying fishermen's communities. And that means there's going to be less fish and, you know, less for people and less economic participation.
Okay.
Don, this is Doug, and I just want to first say I appreciate your observation and your comments. I mean, I think what's really, there's lots of personalities and lots of players in thinking about the future of the oceans, right? But I think certainly speaking personally and from a lot of my colleagues, I mean, I think it's just so important to get this everyone's voices, particularly people's messages, into circulation that are out there every day on the ocean, collecting data in terms of putting nets out and getting fish in them. You know, often so much insight. It's indeed a kind of data collection, a kind of science that's happening. And I certainly appreciate it. I know, you know, as Dean and Crow were saying, they're working actively to actually do more of that themselves, get fishermen involved in this process so that we have numbers that both sides have confidence in, and those are the numbers that we're using for these calculations. So, I certainly appreciate that. And I also, you know, Dean said this earlier, that I was a fisherman myself. I worked my way through college as a fisherman, and I certainly appreciate that it's part of our California coastal heritage. It's part of our, you know, our identity here in Monterey and in San Luis Obispo and in Santa Barbara, and it's not something we want to see lost. It's not something we want to see consolidated into a few single large companies. So I certainly, you know, I certainly share that sentiment. I know there are many people in science that do as well.
In regard to the privatization comment about, you know, New Zealand, I'm not aware of, I didn't know that number, and that is unfortunate. In the United States and here in California, we do have a system that is moving towards giving individuals access to a certain number of fish every single year, and it's supposed to provide them with a sense of security instead of being a free-for-all every year. And there's a lot of debate over the pros and cons of that. However, the, speaking to Don's concern, that system that I just spoke of, it's called a catch share system. It has a rule in it that does not allow consolidation of too many fish or too much, too big of a permit in any one person or one boat's ownership. So we can avoid that result that
so
he talks about in New Zealand.
So someone could buy out, say, a bunch of other people's permits mm-hmm. for that to create a monolithic permit.
Correct. And I think Morro Bay is working on actually making that even more stringent, maybe setting a rule that you have to live in the area to fish in the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Morro Bay is actually doing some really innovative community co-management where fishermen are involved in the management process around this issue, this catch share issue, where the ground fish on the West Coast, the species that live associated with bottom environments, are now into a catch share situation where, as Crow said, you know, each individual in the fishery is given so much catch every year, and then they don't have to – the idea is they're not – there's not a coast-wide quota that everybody's
right.
racing to get.
Right.
There's still a coast-wide quota, but it's divided up by individuals.
Right.
One of the risks that got identified, and Morro Bay's done a wonderful job reacting to this, was that small communities in California like Morro Bay and Port San Luis, when someone left the fishery – they would sell their catch shares. It's a privately traded
right.
Entity. They would sell that outside of our area to someone who has money to buy it, which could be, as Don said, you know, one of these larger companies mm-hmm. that for that particular species maybe is under the quota cap. But they sell that, and then it leaves our community. And over time, the fear here was that those shares would migrate out of the community, and then you're left with a community that can't support the commercial activities because there's not enough people to buy fuel, there's not enough people to land their fish. And so the community here now owns shares and then leases them to fishermen, and if the fisherman gets out of the fishery, it comes back to our community,
right?
So that we can sustain that fishing activity mm-hmm. within this area.
It's not a membership that they can sell to someone
right.
else,
right? Mm-hmm. And so that was a real issue
sure.
for small coastal communities
sure.
that they said, "Oh, in 20 years, we're going to have no fishermen here any
yeah.
longer."
Yeah. What do you think generally that the that in this country, people understand the magnitude of the importance of the ocean's health?
It's a good question. I think so. What do you think?
Well, I'm going to add in that, what has always been really surprising to me is just how diverse an audience gets involved in these conversations. I think there's a lot yet to learn and a lot of obligation on scientists' shoulders to sort of share what the actual tangible values are of the oceans. But I think everyone's incredibly curious. I've been amazed. I've had a few discussions associated with some of the recent research that we did. The news about some of these ocean reports made the front page of the New York Times. We had conversations with conservative media groups, with liberal media groups, and it, to me, that just demonstrated that that there's a broad base of interest in understanding what the future of the oceans is going to be like. So, you know, whether or not we sort of get all of the details is a matter for discussion. And I think, you know, people care about the oceans, but maybe, no pun intended, but not at great depth. so, you know, we think about the future of the oceans, and we conflate that with thinking about whether we're saving the whales or not. But a lot of this discussion, I think, has helped to point out that, you know, it's not at all an issue about saving the whales anymore. This is an issue about saving livelihoods, about keeping economies healthy, about protecting coastal cities, you know. And so I think there's more to be done, and maybe Dean or Craig can speak to that, about some of the services that come from the oceans that that I think we're building awareness about. But there's certainly a lot more to be learned about what the good of the oceans does for us, how our fate is so definitely tangibly tied to the fate of the oceans.
Yeah, I would say that I think, Chris, your question originally was, do people understand mm-hmm. the magnitude and importance of the ocean? I think, you know, in both Crow and Doug mentioned this, people have a tremendous identity with the ocean. They really do. I mean, even in the middle of the country, there's something that there's an identity with the ocean. So I think that people inherently value the ocean. I don't think that people fully appreciate everything that it does for us. I mean, everything from certainly the spiritual aspects that and the feeling you get. How do you value that? But
right.
There's that. There's recreational activities where you're kayaking or looking at birds,
sure.
Surfing, boating. There's food production. We've talked a lot about food production. There's energy production in the form of, wind power that we might ultimately get from floating turbines on the ocean, and then wave energy as well as we move to more renewable sources of energy. And there's also the regulation of our climate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who live on the Central Coast love being here because it's never too hot and never too cold. Well, that's because of our ocean.
Yes.
And, we can begin to – people don't understand that fully. And then we also don't understand – we know we do affect it, and we can change things on a global scale, certainly as well on a local scale. But we don't fully understand how that's going to play out. And how changing the temperature of the ocean or the acidity of the ocean through our land-based activities might alter the place that we live in. And so I think people truly identify with it and value it, but I don't think they fully understand the degree to which it infiltrates our lives.
And maybe not understanding the complexity. When you were
Correct.
Talking about how it's a different system than the land system, when you were just describing, mm-hmm. for instance, fish,
yeah,
you know, and farming fish, if you will, or using fish as a resource for protein, it's not something that I would have thought of. Well, wait a minute. It's not just about an animal eating grass or then moving to another weed.
Right.
It's much more complex.
It's a longer trophic chain.
It's a longer process.
Yes.
Right. You are listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX here in San Luis Obispo and serving the whole Central Coast. We have about 15 minutes left in today's discussion. You are listening to my guest today, Dr. Dean Nguyen, Professor of and Dean of Research at Cal Poly in the Biological Sciences Department, Dr. Douglas, Assistant Professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Marine Biology at UC Santa Barbara, and Dr. Crow White, Assistant Professor of Marine Science in Biology Department at Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo. We have about 15 minutes, so I want to make sure that we're getting on to topics that are important for all three of you to get out to. So your research, Doug? Are there parts of your research that you'd like to share? I think we've lost him. Doug? All right.
Well, I just wanted to, I mean, we were talking about all these different ocean activities, and Crow happens to be an expert in trying to understand how we assemble this new oceanscape as we move forward, and how we take into account all these different activities and how we make them work with one another and find out where they're not compatible and make those trade-offs. So he's published some very well-received and highly regarded work recently.
Thanks, Dean.
In this area. And I think that was something that would be interesting for people to hear about.
Sure, yeah.
We're going to see more of this, even locally.
And this comes back to that term ecosystem-based management, trying to take into account the interactions of all the different fish and the kelp or the coral under the water. And if you remove one thing, how does that change the underwater system? But also the interactions of the different ocean activities and which ones are compatible and which ones are not. And now that we're entering this era where fishing is no longer the only player out there, but there's new ocean uses in the seascape, things like offshore energy and things like aquaculture, we need to start thinking about that carefully. We need to think about it explicitly. Well, how is this new activity going to influence things? And we have a study right now trying to figure that out in relation to aquaculture in Southern California, for example. There's a permit in review for a large mussel aquaculture farm in Southern California. There's also two different industries that are pursuing some fish pen farms, and these are large farms. You know, we're talking about potentially 100-plus acre farms. And that's just because they don't want to ask for a bigger permit because they feel like it's too big of a red flag. They have their sights on even larger operations. And California hasn't really thought about this that much compared with some other nations. And so our study is speaking to that gap in preparation and in saying, okay, well, where could these farms go, for starters?
Mm-hmm.
How much value would they get from the different locations if you put them there? That's the second thing. Then the other side of that whole coin is, well, how's it going to influence everything else? How's it going to influence the underwater ecosystem? And how's it going to influence all the existing users out there? In particular, the fisheries. Because if you put a big farm somewhere, a fishing boat can't go there.
Right.
So you've essentially created a little miniature closure in that spot. And so you need to take that into account. You've all of a sudden that fishing boat that used to go there, it's going to go somewhere else, or it's going to leave the whole industry, which is a shame. You know, we don't necessarily want that to happen. So we're trying to take all that into account in order to evaluate different plans of different types of aquaculture in order to essentially provide a big lookup table or a big roadmap as to how we predict things would play out if the people of California allowed this amount of this type of aquaculture in this and that location.
And welcome back, Doug.
Great to be back. Sorry, I lost you.
So how supportive is local government, national government for this kind of activity?
On the East Coast, they're much more proactive.
Okay.
Massachusetts is the leader in our nation in trying to plan for emerging ocean uses. And they actually, I think, have approved now an offshore wind turbine farm that will involve, I think, a couple hundred wind turbines, kind of in the Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket area. In California, not so much. California has been very hesitant to allow these things to happen. And it's coming to a point now where the industry is knocking on the door pretty loudly, and California is saying, okay, we need to think about this because the door is going to open eventually, and so we want the process to play out in a careful way that takes into account everyone.
We don't want it to just be rammed down.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Slow and careful is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think what Crow is pointing to is that bringing information and planning into the process is just absolutely essential. You know, if we want to draw out this parallel even further to what mistakes we made on land. You know, we had industry sort of knocking on a lot of doors, and those doors just swung open, and we made sort of a mess of things. That's why we ended up with this F-minus, right, on land, if you will. And, I mean, the reality, of course, is in the oceans, we need a lot of the things that industry is after. Industry is knocking loudly because there is demand from consumers for things like new minerals and more protein from the oceans and new and greener energy. So it's by no means a matter of saying no to this development, but you know, as we've been talking about, it's about engaging and engaging the development intelligently and deciding where it can go, where it shouldn't go. If it goes someplace, what are we going to do to offset its footprint there? So yeah, it's an exciting process for sure, and certainly something we're all watching.
So as we're listening to this and as we're wrapping up the show, what can each of us do, or what should we begin to do in order to engage in this? Because obviously this is a process that affects us all. So what do we need to do just as a general person who's going to be part of whatever the outcome is?
Well, I would offer that the more people can do to understand how their activities impact the ocean, the better. What are you eating from the ocean, and where did it come, and whose livelihood is it supporting, and what activities are you doing on land, and how do they end up impacting the ocean? So the more aware people are of their connection and how their activities connect to ocean health, I think the better off we'll be, because it's all about individuals making different choices and changing slowly what they do in a thoughtful way.
And I think having scientists, having individuals who can do the research and then explain the research in a way that it becomes relevant to the average individual, making it interesting, making it understandable, is really kind of falls to you guys.
Oh, I agree with you.
To do that.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that it's a skill that that needs to be honed in academia. But I think that academia, universities have a huge amount to contribute to this dialogue.
Yes.
And professors should get credit for doing it.
Absolutely.
And they need to train to do it, essentially. It doesn't come naturally.
Yeah.
The job is maybe a little easier for us in the oceans, as we've been talking about, just because it's something people are so deeply interested in. I mean, it's a lot harder to communicate science, for example, if you're talking about nanoparticle physics, as it is if you're talking about development and planning development and the economics of things going to be sitting outside our oceanfront lawns. But I agree with you, Dean, 100%, that it's our obligation and critically important to, you know, have the kinds of dialogues, Chris, that you're hosting today. So important a part of this process.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining me today. My guests have been Dr. Dean Wendt, Professor and Dean of Research at Cal Poly in the Biological Sciences Department, Dr. Douglas, Assistant Professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Marine Biology at UC Santa Barbara, and Dr. Crow White, Assistant Professor of Marine Science and Biology Department of California Polytechnic State San Luis Obispo, and the listeners who called in today with comments and questions. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX, and made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Next week on Central Coast Voices, your host, Fred Monroe, will be joined by guests from the San Luis Obispo Tobacco Control. And they will discuss how communities can work together to decrease tobacco-related diseases and deaths on the Central Coast, and resources available for those who want to quit. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and I thank you for joining me today on Central Coast Voices.